Hi, welcome to the Illusion of More podcast. I'm David Newhoff. This time last year, I had the opportunity to talk to Dr. David Price of London-based NetNames shortly after they released a report on the scale and scope of media piracy worldwide. Presently, Dr. Price is in Washington, D.C., where, along with collaborator Tom Galvin of the Digital Citizens Alliance, he officially released a new report on piracy, this one focused entirely on sites known as cyberlockers. Titled Behind the Cyberlocker Door, the report focuses on the top 30 sites that use this technology to facilitate and profit from the illegal distribution of copyrighted content, like motion pictures, music, books, and video games. The report describes how these black market businesses function and how they earn their money. And among the more striking aspects of the study is the fact that Visa and MasterCard, despite claims to the contrary, are facilitating transactions for these cyberlocker sites. Moreover, users of these sites may be surprised to learn that signing up for premium accounts to enable faster downloads could well expose them to malware designed to enable identity theft. And with that, thank you, Dr. Price, for joining me on the Illusion of More podcast. It's good to talk to you again.
Yes, it is. I think it was almost exactly a year ago that we were discussing the NetNames' last report in this area. So I'm very glad to be returning to have another chance to chat to you about our latest research.
Thank you. Yeah, it was almost exactly a year. Maybe this will become an annual thing for us. Let me ask right off the bat, for those who don't know, could you briefly define what a cyberlocker is and why you chose to focus on this type of site for this report?
Sure. A cyberlocker is a large centralized online hosting service. We focused on two main types of cyberlocker for this report. What we call direct download cyberlockers. These are sites that centrally host any type of user uploaded file, whether it's a film or a television episode or a piece of music, a book, game, piece of software, whatever it might be, it can be uploaded and stored online. We also looked at streaming cyberlockers. These are video-focused services. You upload a piece of content to it, a piece of video content, and the content is then streamed back to you. Now, one of the important things to note about cyberlockers is that generally they're not searchable. You can't go to a site like ZippyShare, for instance, and search all of the content that's held on that site. They make the content available only in links to the person who's uploaded it, but then there's no restriction whatsoever on how that link can be used. So the person who uploaded that piece of content can spread that link far and wide across the internet. And what cyberlockers hope you'll do is spread that link so far and so wide that as many people as possible will come to their site, view their advertising, and possibly sign up to premium accounts that they offer, which provide an enhanced service, faster downloads, advert-free experience, so that the cyberlocker ends up gaining as much revenue from that content as possible.
Right. Do you think that the consumers out there continue to be confused about the difference between a cyberlocker and a cloud storage service like Dropbox?
I think it's an easy mistake to make. Superficially, both of these types of site offer the ability to store your content online, store it in the cloud, store it centrally on a server somewhere. But there are some significant differences. And as soon as you dig into how these services actually operate, you can see that a cyberlocker is very different to a cloud storage provider like Dropbox. Cyberlockers, for instance, as I said, they're interested in you spreading that content as widely as possible, whereas a service like Dropbox, it's really personally aimed. It's aimed at the individual who's uploaded a piece of content. It's for them to share that content perhaps with some family and friends, and it's for them to be able to synchronize that material between their different devices. They're offering a very different service to a cyberlocker, which has unrestricted bandwidth, which has no way of monitoring for infringing content. And I think one good way of differentiating between the two services is to think about who the client is for each service. Who's making the money, or where is the money coming from? So for a cyberlocker, the money is coming from the downloader. That's their client. They want the downloader to come to their site, view their advertising, pay for the premium accounts, gain the benefits from that. And the revenue is being delivered by the downloaders who want the free content that's being held on the CyberLocker. Whereas for the cloud storage provider, the client is the uploader. It's the person who wants to store their files, who wants to be able to synchronize those files between different devices. So they're aiming their business models at very, very different people in very, very different ways.
And I ask it because I know a lot of people try to sort of, you know, when I say people, I mean those who would defend piracy sort of try to claim a technicality that, you know, oh, well, anything could be stored on a CyberLocker, and that's technically true. And although the way that the CyberLocker is designed, it seems, is specifically designed to foster massive infringement. And sharing of those kinds of files. And additionally, the way the technology is designed seems to give rise to claims like we heard from Kim.com to say, well, it's not me anyway, it's all the users. I can't be held responsible for what's on there. Is that accurate?
Well, it's an interesting claim to make. You know, CyberLockers are, as far as we can tell, fairly rife with infringement. They don't tend to have any practices which help them restrict the use of their services for infringement. We put research into this report where we looked at all 30 CyberLockers that we examined, 15 direct download CyberLockers, 15 streaming CyberLockers. We found the rate of infringement to be anywhere between, I think, about 75% and 85%, depending on the type of site. So the vast majority of the content that we examined on those sites, where we found links to them, was infringing. And that's a fairly conservative minimum. We weren't examining the infringing status of any pornography files we found, for instance, which, you know, entirely legitimate type of material, but we didn't look at all. And if you look at other research in this area, Richard Waterman did a piece of research on Hotfile, for instance, for the case for the MPAA against that site. That particular piece of research found that 90.2% of all downloads from the site, so not the content that had been uploaded, but the content that was being demanded by other users, the content that was being downloaded, was infringing. So you're looking at sites which have significant amounts of infringing material on them. And you're also looking at sites which don't necessarily respond as well as they should to DMCA takedowns. They'll sometimes drag their heels somewhat in removing content. They don't really make it easy to remove content often. You'll have to click through a whole bunch of links, often showing adverts, to find the DMCA takedown link in the first place. And these are sites which could implement various ways of monitoring for infringing content, but have never really chosen to. Dropbox, for instance, has a form of content identification where they look at video files that are uploaded and examine whether they're infringing or not. Whereas CyberLockers tend to shy away from installing any kind of service like that, which would be, you know, a fairly easy way of identifying what's out there and identifying if people are abusing their services for infringement.
Your report reveals, you go into a fair bit of detail in trying to understand the nature of the business and how the business works. And your report makes clear that that these sites can be very profitable, you know, ranging, of course, but that overall that they're quite profitable. Do you think most people, even potentially some users of CyberLockers, would be surprised to learn how profitable these enterprises are?
I think they would be. One of the core tenets of infringement online is often that it's all about sharing content. It has a kind of people often view it as through rose-tinted glasses. I'm sharing material with my friends. I'm giving them access to something that I've really enjoyed. You know, it's a happy thing that people enjoy doing for others. But I think one of the reasons we chose to focus on CyberLockers so explicitly for this report is that more than any other file sharing ecosystem, it really is all about money. It infects the entire process The reason why many people upload files to CyberLockers is because they get paid for it. They operate, the services operate affiliate or reward schemes on a fairly frequent basis. If you upload a popular file, you'll get paid for people who download it. Or if those people choose to click through and buy a premium account, you get a cut of that revenue. And then you look at the advertising that is rife across these sorts of sites. It's almost impossible to go to one of these cyber lockers without being assailed by various different pop-ups, various different adverts, often very, very deceptively put on the page to make you click them. And then there's the whole issue of premium accounts. And if you look at how the premium accounts are marketed by these sites, it's all about downloading. It's not about storing your files online and synchronizing them to different devices. It's about having access to the content hosted on these cyber lockers as quickly as possible, being able to download as many files as you want as fast as possible, and having no restrictions on being able to access all the material that's stored on these sorts of sites.
And since we're there on revenues, in the report you explain that the revenues are derived by advertising, that they're derived also by selling these premium accounts, which makes sense, where people use a credit card and buy a so-called premium account or a third-party software that enables downloads to be faster, more efficient. But even then, it sounds from the report like that business may even still be sort of just a loss leader, not a loss leader, it's profitable leader, for the real goal, which is to install malware into users' computers and devices, and that the end game here may well be identity theft.
Certainly on some of the sites that we researched, we did find some very questionable practices and some very questionable adverts and pop-ups and other areas where the cyber locker was either actively promoting or at least passively accepting the installation of very questionable programs on some users' computers. We're actually looking at a piece of research. We're looking at publishing it in the next month or so, which does some explicit research on the links between malware and piracy. And as part of that research, we used an industry partner who has very extensive experience both with law enforcement and with major internet companies, looking at cybercrime, looking at the spread of malware, viruses, and botnets. And they shared some data with us on the rates of infection from different sites. We gave them a long, long list of CyberLocker sites, BitTorrent sites, and others. And they were able to show us that around 50% of the CyberLockers that we provided them had been responsible in some way for the infection of malware onto a user's computer. Now, in some areas, that may well be deliberately pushed onto the user. And in some areas, it may be a more passive acceptance through an advert that had been placed on the site. And in some areas, it would be malware gangs that are unrelated to the CyberLocker, simply using the CyberLocker as a free distribution mechanism. If you've got a site which is getting millions of unique users, why not use it to use their free hosting for your malware distribution gang and push those files onto as many people as you can.
And I have to say that one of the most striking revelations in the report is that may be news to some people who don't follow these things is the fact that Visa and MasterCard are not only facilitating these transactions, but are presumably making money on these transactions, right?
Absolutely. We were quite surprised. We found of the 25 CyberLockers who offer premium accounts, 24 of them accepted Visa and MasterCard. It's the dominant way to pay for this sort of material online and for this sort of service online. Visa and MasterCard will be taking a cut of all of those processing transactions. In the main, they were going through payment processors online who were based in various different jurisdictions around the world. But You know, in all cases, they were using the Visa and MasterCard logo to promote their services on the CyberLocker sites. And the Visa and MasterCard would, at the end of the day, be taking their typical cut from any kind of transaction which occurs using their systems. And what's interesting, I think, is that both Visa and MasterCard have said in the past quite strongly that they will not do business with sites that infringe content. MasterCard has an anti-piracy policy that you can download from its website, and they state quite clearly in that that they will not do business with sites that infringe copyright, and they will not do business with services that let people pay for this sort of content, and that if they find one, they will not just refuse them service through whichever payment processor they're using, they will blacklist them across the entire MasterCard network. I think the main issue is that that is obviously not happening at the moment.
No, it's not. And I can't help but think of the old Visa commercials where, you know, they'd show like the Olympics or whatever, and it would the end, the tagline would always be, and bring your Visa card, because they don't take American Express. I can imagine a commercial for one of these CyberLocker sites doing a similar thing. But that aside, looking at the whole report, what does the data in the report suggest to you might be some realistic solutions to pursue at this point in terms of addressing the problems?
I think there's two significant areas which could be looked at in a bit more depth. And the first of those is to look at the role of the payment processors, look at the role of the credit card companies, because they have stated quite clearly that infringement is not a game that they want to be involved in. You know, I realize that there may be questions in their mind about perhaps how these services might have some non-infringing use, but it's easy to use a CyberLocker to host any kind of file, but our research found that most of the content hosted on these sites was infringing. You know, and these sites work to encourage infringement in the ways that we've already talked about. And I think if you look at how PayPal has addressed this area, you see that there are ways forward for this. 3 years ago, if I was talking to you about this and you'd asked about payment processors, I'd be talking to you about PayPal, because PayPal would have been accepted universally across all of these sites. And yet today, we only found one of these CyberLockers that accepted PayPal. So PayPal have taken a stance. They've decided that for whatever reason, and it may well be selfish that they were seeing a lot of chargebacks and fraud coming through some of the transactions, but they've decided that they do not want to be associated with sites that offer infringement, not just CyberLockers. It goes right through the piracy spectrum. But they've taken a decision not to do this. And you see that even new CyberLockers that launch don't even bother to try and set up a PayPal account, because they know it will be refused, or they know that even if they get away with it for a few weeks or a month, that PayPal will eventually find out what they're doing, and PayPal will shut them down and not allow them access to the money that's been gained. So they don't even bother with that anymore. They just turn direct to the people that they know they will be able to use, and that's Visa and MasterCard in the majority of cases. So I think that's one of the main areas where we could see some improvement. And it will take some pressure on Visa and MasterCard to really stand up and pay attention to this problem. And the second area, I think, is advertising. One of the interesting things we found in this report about advertising is the dominance of one particular advertising network. They're called Propeller Ads Media, and they were found on 17 of the 29 sites which used advertising within this study. Just as far as you can tell by looking at their website, they're a typical advertising network. They're happy to work with different publishers and different websites. But when you start talking to them and you start looking at how widely they're used across the piracy world, and again, not just on CyberLockers, but we also see them crop up on BitTorrent sites, music download sites, and similar. When you start to dig into what they're offering and where they're based and what they're up to, you start to see some quite questionable practices. They're primarily operating inside Russia, which isn't questionable in itself, but they're actually incorporated in the Seychelles. They have a corporate address, in this offshore location in the Seychelles. And if you start to dig into that corporate address, you find very, very, very little, very, very little information, which is not surprising given the lax corporate regulations in places like the Seychelles. So I talked to one of their account managers. I got a lot of detail on the sorts of revenue that might be possible if I was operating a CyberLocker site, the ways in which they place their content on these particular sites. And one of the things that's really intriguing about the way in which Propeller Ads Media works and the way in which they're structured is that it actually mirrors the way in which a lot of these piracy sites are structured. Based in the Eastern Europe or in Russia, and with a corporate headquarters in some shady offshore location. Foreshared, for instance, the largest direct download CyberLocker, is incorporated in the British Virgin Islands, but is based in Russia. RapidGator, TurboBit, they are incorporated through small companies in Cyprus, but again, based in Eastern European locations where your corporate regulation is lax, and where legal enforcement, where law enforcement, where legal mitigation measures might be very, very difficult to pursue. So it's a pattern that's repeated, and it's across the CyberLocker sites. It's also concerning, I think, that it's starting to be repeated across the advertising networks.
Right. Well, and to my knowledge, the advertisers in this case don't really, this is a realm of internet advertising placement that they don't really purposely control. Advertisers don't seek to put their brands on these sites, that they are in a secondary or tertiary market where they end up there. And that being the case, do you have any thoughts on how the brands who have an interest in protecting their image could play a role in controlling that?
It is a very complex space, as you say, and I think as you mentioned, the brands probably aren't aware that their adverts are appearing on this type of site and next to this type of infringing content. It's an incredibly complex world. I've tried to dig into the advertising world and understand the technical structures of how adverts are placed, but it's something that confuses me. So I can imagine it's something that probably confuses some of the actors within the advertising space itself. But what you do notice is that when you often click on an advert on some of these sorts of sites, you are taken through three or four different servers belonging to probably different advertising networks before you reach your destination. So, as you say, it's secondary, tertiary net levels of advertising placement. You know, it's often remnant space that's being sold. And I think the brands would have difficulty in tracing exactly how their adverts are being placed. I'm sure they do fairly good due diligence on the advertising networks that they sell to. But it goes further down the line. You know, they have their main advertising network. Their advertising network sells their space to other networks. They may well sell their space on to even further networks. So there's a difficulty of control there. And I think there's space for some of the advertising trade bodies to start to take a stance in this area and start to look quite clearly about how they might be able to help major brands control where their advertising is appearing. It doesn't do them much good if they're advertising a Cadillac car, as we saw, on a site that's predominantly used by 18-year-old downloaders. They're not going to find a very good ready market for major automotives amongst that kind of demographic. So it's not just the association with these sorts of sites. It's the fact that it's not going to be very effective marketing if they are appearing on those sorts of sites.
Yeah, that's correct. It's waste in advertising parlance. For anybody who would like to read the report, should they go to NetNames, Digital Citizens Alliance, both?
They can go to either of them. I recommend you go to both, though. It's freely available from both NetNames and Digital Citizens Alliance. I believe Digital Citizens Alliance will also supply you with a nice handy infographic if you go there, so you might be able to get a bonus by visiting their site rather than just visiting us.
Terrific. Dr. Price, I want to thank you again for joining me today. It's been a pleasure talking to you once again.
It's always my pleasure to have a good chat with you, David.
Terrific. Well, enjoy the rest of your stay in Washington, D.C., and safe journey back to what is still the United Kingdom.
I left it in safe hands, and I'm glad to see it's still united when I'll be returning.
All right. All the best, then.
Thanks very much.